Not only should we be working with the region to further the rules-based order, but we need to show that we also respect principles of multiculturalism, pluralism, and equality on the domestic front.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National.
Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Rory Medcalf, head of the ANU National Security College. Before we begin, I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land on which this podcast is being recorded, the Ngunnawal and Ngambri people, and pay my respects to their elders. This is a special episode of our podcast because it's the first in a series of recordings from our major conference held recently in April 2024. The conference, Securing Our Future, was an effort to build a national conversation about Australia's interests, values, identity, resilience, and future security. And we brought together experts, practitioners, emerging voices, not only from around Australia, but from around the world. And this particular session of the conference has a certain relevance, sadly, in light of recent awful events in Sydney, which have highlighted really the threat to social cohesion, the threat to a sense of safety in the Australian community. And one of the topics of the conference, in fact, several of the topics of the conference really get to the core of that issue. So in this session, we look at one and three, the question of Australia's interests, values, and national identity, and how we can realistically look to greater cohesion in the face of risks and threats. And of course, one and free is a line from the Australian National Anthem, which we don't often think about, but which can be quite telling in defining our security. In this session, I'm delighted to hand the chair to Ian Kemmish, who is a distinguished advisor with the National Security College and also a very experienced former senior official with assignments such as being High Commissioner in Papua New Guinea, ambassador to Germany as well. Ian chairs a discussion featuring a number of experts and practitioners from the conference representing quite a range of perspectives, including Wessa Chow, Professor Asmi Wood from this university, Afia Akand, and parliamentarians Zoe McKenzie and Allegra Spender. Together, they delve into the guiding interests and values behind Australia's security priorities, but above all, they look at questions of identity and unity, fundamental issues of national cohesion and motivation during these challenging times. This panel looks at how security can be integrated with other interests like prosperity, cohesion, and sustainability, while aligning or not with those pillars of contemporary Australian identity. And don't be deceived, there's not consensus on this panel, there's a range of views. So you'll hear them cover some big issues: multiculturalism, equity, inclusion, and democracy. It's a rich, engaging, sometimes confronting discussion, and it's a great debut for the many recordings we will be releasing from this conference. Together, we hope these materials will help set the scene for a national conversation on security and set the scene for community-based consultations that the team will be conducting around Australia later this year. Thank you.
Australians all, let us rejoice, for we are one and free. Are we? Ladies and gentlemen, Australian policymakers and strategic commentators are currently focused on the potential for geostrategic tensions in our region to lead to conflict. This morning, we're asking if there is an Australian identity or a set of values that we all think are worth defending, and whether that sense of identity is cohesive enough to withstand what may be coming. Should we be worried that some of the non-traditional security challenges we face, climate change, economic stagnation, political polarisation, foreign interference and extremism, have the potential to tear at the ties which bind us together? I'm going to ask each of my speakers to begin by addressing a question. I think we all understand we're going to try and keep that to about 2 minutes each. And in doing so, I'll introduce them. The question's this: how important actually is this topic? Why should we be talking about national identity in the context of national security? Asmi Wood is a professor at the ANU Law School, a barrister and a solicitor. He supports the ANU College of Law Indigenous program and has directed the National Centre for Indigenous Studies. What do you think, Asmi? Why is this important, or is it?
Good morning, everybody, and thanks very much for having me here. I'd like to acknowledge that we are on Ngambri and Ngunnawal land, never ceded, and sovereignty was never ceded at all by our people. It is an important question, but the question is, who is this plurality of we that we are talking about? Leadership was a big issue that came up, and because Indigenous leadership is not really valued or recognised, can I give you an example of after the referendum that we had? A lot of lies were told, you know, and that's politics, you know, I mean, it's dirty and people do horrible things. But do you know when the referendum was lost, what the Aboriginal leadership told the Aboriginal people to do? They said, keep quiet for 2 weeks. Don't talk when you're angry. Don't talk when you're hurt. This is the kind of leadership that kept this continent safe for 80,000 years, 60,000 years, who knows. We say time immemorial. So when you're looking for leadership and identity and all of that, as the minister spoke about Uncle Noel Pearson's words, I encourage you to look towards the wisdom of the longest living cultures on this continent.
Thanks very much, Asmi. Wesa Chow is Public Policy Director at the Multicultural Leadership Initiative. She's on the advisory board of the National Foundation for Australia-China Relations and on Victoria's Anti-Racism Task Force. Her research has focused on the Asian diaspora's contribution in philanthropy, leadership, cultural diplomacy and politics. What do you think, Wesa?
Yeah, so I also want to acknowledge the traditional owners and pay my respects to the elders past, present and emerging, and acknowledge that land was never ceded as well. And I think just drawing back on the Assistant Minister's comments about the three pillars, I think my focus is really on the multicultural communities. And in working with the Chinese community, particularly at the time when the tension between Australia and China has been very challenging, during that time, there's a lot of angst within the community about what they can say and what they can't say. So when we talk about national identity, for many Chinese Australians, it didn't include them. And self-censoring was also very real within the community at the time, because the space in the media and also in Parliament, the discussions in Parliament was also not safe for Chinese Australians. So I was one of the three Chinese Australians that was asked to publicly pledge loyalty to Australia. So it is incidents like this that makes it really challenging for people to feel belong in a country where, for some of them, they were born here and this is the only country they've known. But yet to be seen as, people who don't belong makes it really challenging to have that conversation and to have the national identity conversation to feel like that they actually reflected in that conversation, especially when you listen to the media, when you listen to national conversations, it didn't really include their point of view. And so there's no trust. When there's no trust, it's really hard for certain members of the community to actually be accepted and actually accept that national identity to be part of them.
Thanks so much. Allegra Spender MP was elected in 2022 as the independent member for Wentworth on a platform of climate action, political integrity, future-focused economic reform, gender equity and decency. Allegra has a background as a business analyst and as a policy analyst within the UK Treasury. What's your perspective? What's the perspective from Wentworth on this?
Look, I think Wentworth has one of the biggest Jewish populations in the country, probably the biggest population. So when I think about social cohesion and how important that is, I think a lot about that and my community and the fact that, you know, speaking to university students now who feel, who've hired their Jewish identity at university and I think in feeling the sort of need to dissociate, you know, actually step away from places like that. And that as a child of a migrant, as a person who identifies as a, with, you know, that those three pillars of Noel Pearson's Australia, I find that deeply concerning. So social cohesion is absolutely critical. We had the Shadow Defence Minister quote Beowulf. I'm going to quote Philip II of Macedon, father of Alexander the Great, who said, you know, whose strategy was divide and conquer. And I think that is critical when we think about, you know, is national or social cohesion, national unity important? Well, absolutely. And it has been for thousands of years because when we are divided, we are vulnerable. And I think we have, you know, there are themes out there globally, you know, whether it be, you know, climate change and the impact that has, you know, geopolitical tensions of economic stagnation, all those areas drive sort of division. Then you have the sort of technology advances, which are also driving those three P's of populism, post-truth and polarisation, which are, I think, deep threats to Australia. And I think, so there are many factors that I think both externally and internally that are driving against social cohesion. But if we do not maintain that social cohesion and national identity, then we are even more vulnerable.
Thanks so much, Allegra. Afia Arkand is on the National Security College's Youth Council and is a researcher at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute. She attended the 2022 IMF and World Bank Group annual meetings as a Global Voices Scholar and represented Australia at the 2022 QuadMin Emerging Leaders Dialogue. A young voice. Afia, what do you think?
I mean, I feel young, but at the same time, I also feel quite aged, especially working at ASPI and the sort of issues that we do look at. I think for me personally, and quickly also, I'd like to say Eid Mubarak to all who are celebrating today. So Eid al-Fitr signifies the end of the holy month of Ramadan for Muslims around the world. In particular, there are 800,000 Australians who identify as coming from the Islamic faith, according to the last census. So when it comes to these issues around national security, I tend to take quite an expansive lens when it comes to national identity. We need to be first strong internally as a country on the domestic front. We need to be socially cohesive when we talk about these topics. National security also applies to economic security, environmental security, and our society as well. And we know that in terms of building a strong national identity, it also is a question of how we engage our region. And as Andrew Hasty and Tim Watts has highlighted, bolstering bilateral and multilateral ties with the region is very, very critical, including with means through the Quad, ASEAN, Pacific Island forums, and also through AUKUS or JAUKUS, which is currently potentially might be occurring. But in order to increase our credibility within the region and to be a security partner of choice for countries in the region, we need to show that we respect our regional counterparts and we care about their way of doing things. So on the domestic front, this really means addressing some of the hypocrisies and push back against accusations of virtue signalling. Not only should we be working with the region to further the rules-based order, but we need to show that we also respect principles of multiculturalism, pluralism and equality on the domestic front. So as already been highlighted by Rory, by Tim, we can't ignore our history. We have to look at these historical injustices and systemic disadvantages that plague Australian society, whether that's First Nations Australians, multicultural Australians, women, And it's particularly important in the context of the ongoing Israel-Hamas war, especially with the rise of anti-Semitism, Islamophobia since October 7. Of course, these conversations around national identity are deeply difficult, but they're integral. If we are to foster a strong and inclusive national identity, including one that celebrates and promotes inclusion, we only stand to benefit when it comes to engaging our regional counterparts.
Thanks, Afia. Zoe McKenzie, MP, is the federal member for Flinders, also elected in 22. Zoe has a background in small business. She's worked in international trade as a board director, including with the NBN and Australian Council for the Arts, and has practiced employment and equal opportunity law. What do you make of all of this, Zoe?
Thanks, Ian. So I think we've had a beautiful conversation already just amongst the panel, but equally in the presentation given by Tim in terms of national identity and the various questions that sit in front of us, all of which are very important. The key one for me is how well placed is this in a national security environment? With great esteem for everyone in the room, I don't feel this ecosystem is the best one to tackle our issues of national identity. I see that better written by the historians, the writers, the performers, the thinkers, more so in the humanities than I would in a national security debate, only because I see some parts of that discussion of national identity as deeply divisive and exactly what those who wish to threaten our national security would seek to exploit. So there's a place and a time for it, and it's more on either the humanities in places, great establishments like the ANU, or indeed in the way we present our soft diplomacy. The work that Tim described is one I had seen when I worked in the trade department. We present very much as modern Australia throughout our international network, and we should continue to do so. And indeed, we do increasingly in our parliament, and we've got more work to do there as well.
Interesting. Thank you. Let's pick up on that point a little. As my fellow panellists know, I'm going to pluck not entirely randomly from the group to ask some questions, but they all feel free to jump in if they'd like. Just thinking about Zoe's last point, is there actually a concept of national security that we can all agree on? Ask me.
I'm not really sure, to be honest. They say nationalism is the last refuge of the scoundrel. So, you know, when you talk about values, people say these are Australian values. But if you go to Indonesia, they have the same values. They're human values. And when people try and nationalize it or sequester these kinds of human values and then demonize the other side, the question is, what is security? You know, I mean, all human beings want to raise their children, love them, care for them, provide an education as best they can, and live so that we can develop as in an intellectual and a spiritual kind of way. That's what we want. And all human beings want that. And if all human beings or most human beings can have that, then we will be secure. You know, a unipolar world, I'm not sure how it'll work. You know, countries rise and fall, not because anybody wants them to, but because nobody else can stop them. And, you know, you see civilizations rising and civilizations falling. Again, I turn back to, you know, the indigenous people of this continent, who, of course, we had fights and we had, you know, conflicts and stuff like that. But because there were stylized wars, stylized conflicts, you get people living largely in peace with their neighbours. And I guess this is what we want. Of course, you know, we live in a world where we have terrifying weapons. I'm not really sure. This is not my area. I'm a lawyer. I don't really understand a lot of this stuff. But I do understand that all human beings want the same kinds of things. And if I give my neighbour what he or she wants, then he or she is likely to reply in kind.
So the question is, concept of national security, is there something we can agree on? It's definitional. Zoe, can I go back over the room to you on this?
Yeah, look, I'm sure I take quite a stripped back view of national security, in that it's about protecting land, people, sovereignty, and indeed making sure you have a secure buffer around that, and therefore collaborating, as Andrew said in his observations about Pax Americana and Pax Britannica, aligning ourselves with those who share those views and share those systems of government, particularly Western democracies, which are defined by free speech. So that's my concept, and it's a fairly, one might say, sober definition of what national security is, but that is the end that we spend a lot of time thinking about in terms of defence expenditure, the architecture of the nation, the collaboration within our region. So, of course, there are broader versions of that, but this is the version of it that we spend a lot of time in that other place across the lake thinking about and funding.
Wessa, what do you think of this point?
I think if we don't have a backdrop of racial inequality, the conversation might be a little bit more different. But at the same time, when we think about communities being, you know, discriminated against and not feeling belong in their own country, the conversation becomes a little bit more complex, because when we think about different values, so even just taking, for example, you know, we want to be free. Like we want a free society. Now, people would agree with the term free, but then when you really drill down to the practicalities, for certain communities, they might not be free. So when I talk about, for example, with the Chinese community, during the time when the tension was very high, self-censoring was real. So it wasn't free for them. It was free for people who agree with the mainstream conversation about China, but it's not free for people who might have a different view. They might not necessarily be, you know, on China's side, but they have a more nuanced perspective of, you know, what's happening. But that conversation is not being reflected. And I even had, for example, international students from Singapore who had a, you know, completely different perspective on what's been discussed at their university, but couldn't talk about it because they feel like their perspective is not accepted in the classroom. And this is not even, you know, a person from China. It's people who are in our region who might have a different perspective on our conversation on national security, but it's not, you know, accepted and not been able to freely discuss their point of view. And I think we need to have those conversations and be able to accept some of those different views so that we can form and actually knowing what our region is thinking as well. So obviously the government might have engagement with the region and the governments in the region, but then we also need to know what the people of our region is also thinking, and they might be different from what the government, their governments are thinking.
Thank you. Look, let's drive closer to what I think is at the core of this, the intention here. Defending ourselves presumably requires some level of consensus about who we are, what we're defending, our principles, our values, our way of life. Can we agree on a sense of national identity for Australia? And maybe if I can add a question to that, I mean, you know, what are the risks? What are the risks to a sense of unity that we see? So, you know, is there an agreed sense of national identity, and where are the challenges to that? Allegra, can you start us off on that?
Look, I think back to the citizenship ceremonies I am involved in, but it's one of the big and it's one of the joyful parts of being an MP. And I have to read out a statement as part of that, you know, which is about becoming Australian. And, you know, a few pieces, covers effectively Noel Pearson's words about the sort of three threads of Australia's history, of our Indigenous history, of our democratic institutions, and of our multicultural Australia. And there's this piece about, you know, equality, you know, again, you know, and your equality based on, you know, sexuality, ethnicity, you know, disability, anything, you know, you're all equal in front of the law. This, and there's sort of two pieces I think are really key to it. Is one is diversity is our greatest strength. And I think that is, if I was going to say what what is a value of Australia, what makes – I think that that kind of comes, I think, to a sense of what is it is to be Australian. And then the other big one is the idea of a fair go. And I know those are trite and, you know, overused, but I do think that there is in – I guess that's – those are the closest, I think, to I come to a sense of what are the values of this country that we sort of align around. And, you know, when I look at, you know, the conflict overseas and, you know, how difficult that is, I think I come back to, you know, what do we – what do people agree on? And that is that, you know, many come to Australia because – because we as a diverse country can work together. And I think that's something that I think a lot of Australians hold on to, even when they have strong views about, you know, what is happening overseas and different perspectives. So I think when I think about what it is to be Australian and how, what we can build on, I think it is that sense of we come to Australia to show what diversity, how diversity is not disunity, but diversity can actually create greater unity in the way that, you know, a team which truly embraces diversity is actually stronger and more powerful than a team of groupthink. And I think that is the same for Australia. The team that truly embraces our diversity can actually harness unity in a different way. So I think that's, and the fair go, I think is also really critical. So when I come to national identity, those are probably the two themes I really think about.
Afia, can we all sign up to that?
Yeah, definitely. So definitely agree with Allegra around the fair go and equality of opportunities. But going one step further, not only about diversity, but the inclusion aspect of it. So not only being tolerant of the fact that we have a multicultural society or we have the longest continuous culture in the world, but the fact that Australians, regardless of their background, whether that's based on sexual orientation, racial background, faith group, gender expression, that all Australians feel empowered and safe to proceed with their lives without fear or prejudice or discrimination. And as Tim Watson really beautifully highlighted within in his remarks, multicultural inclusion is really one of these values we really actively need to fight for. And it's not something that we can take for granted. We have the most diverse society in the world, and we have, since the 1970s, have had a policy of multiculturalism. And we should be really proud of the achievements we've made on that front. And we actively celebrate our diversity wins through Harmony Week, through celebrating community events, whether that's Lunar New Year, IT events every year on the community level. But we can't just stop there. When we are cultivating a national identity, we really need to actively fight for multiculturalism to ensure that there is leadership representation, which is within Wes's work, ensuring that there's inclusion within the business sector, media, academia, politics, the national security community as well when it comes to multiculturalism. And as we become more multicultural in our identity, definitely one of those risks I see are those issues around discrimination and prejudice. But often we tend to sideline or think that's a one-off issue if there are these issues of racism or discrimination that do emerge. But this year we marked the 5th year anniversary of the Christchurch mosque shootings, where a young Australian man murdered 51 Muslims in New Zealand mosques, whose only crime was to be worshipping peacefully at Friday prayers. And despite the fact that Australia and New Zealand and other countries, we have these really powerful counterterrorism mechanisms that we do celebrate multiculturalism openly, it didn't stop this man and many others adopting these far-right views about immigration, Islam, cultural diversity. And obviously with the Israel-Hamas war, more recently Islamophobia and anti-Semitism really increasing. In the first 7 weeks of the conflict since October 7, we saw a 13-fold increase in Islamophobic incidents recorded by the Islamophobia Register Australia when compared with 2022. 13-fold increase. And these aren't just one-offs, because every time there are these geopolitical events, whether it's an increase in anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, anti-immigrant sentiment, we see this occur time and time again on a systemic level. So as a country, when it comes to fighting for our national identity and fighting for inclusion, it's not just about talking the talk and these tokenistic means of trying to embrace our multiculturalism, but it's really about fighting for inclusion, whether that's at leadership or calling out problematic behaviour, including prejudice.
Asmi, is plurality a strength?
I think plurality is a strength, and I think legal plurality is a strength. And English common law is legally plural, though Australian common law is not. I work with a lot of young people. I mean, I'm privileged to meet the best, beautiful young people, you know, who I have the privilege of teaching at this wonderful university. And a lot of them just don't seem to know whether they're Arthur or Martha. It's this sense of identity is really confusing to a lot of them. I don't know whether it's about growing up. As you grow older, you sort of become more secure. In Aboriginal communities, this is not really an issue. People say, this is my country, this is where I'm from, this is my mob. Identity is not such a huge issue. But I think, you know, the divisiveness of a lot of things, and this is not about politics, it's people on... I live on college here, and we were watching the news. A beautiful young Jewish woman who voted for Allegra from her electorate, and a young Malaysian woman, Bahasa Melayu speaking woman, were sitting next to each other. And there was this soccer match where somebody did a Nazi salute, and both of them were shocked. And then both of them looked at each other and laughed and said, oh gosh, that's so scary that these guys are doing this. And, you know, there is no anger or hatred. You know, it's a common thing that, and that young man, I mean, I don't know why he did what he did. He was probably 19 and needs to grow up a little bit. But, you know, so these, the sense of identity of who people are strong, and yet they seem to be able to coalesce around things. And I hope that, you know, this is what we develop into as a nation. So the three strands that Uncle Noel was talking about, yes, there are three strands, but one of them is really fat and the other two are really thin. So, you know, I think that's the part that we need to get a bit more equality on this. Aboriginal people in the Constitution are not equal to everybody else. That needs to change. I mean, this was a document written by the founding fathers, you know, in the 1800s, late 1800s. And yet the provision that allows Parliament to make laws, you know, against Aboriginal people, and as Justice French has said, it has only been used against Aboriginal people since 67, that these things need to change. When we have legal equality, when we have that, then I think we can all say, look, we are equal, and then start working together.
We'll be right back.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
In this disrupted world, Australia needs security professionals more than ever. Join the next generation studying at the ANU National Security College. Our programs uniquely fuse academic knowledge with practitioner experience and fit around your lifestyle with study offered online and on campus. Follow the link in the show notes for more information about programs and scholarships. The ANU National Security College. Engaging minds for a secure Australia.
Look, thanks for introducing a sense of problem, because, you know, in the lead up to this panel, we all agreed that we weren't going to sit and admire the problem, that we were going to be constructive. But I must say, we've all been very up and very positive so far. Can we maybe go to the other side of the coin? We heard a bit about language, including from Andrew Hastie this morning. The quality of political and social discourse. I'm looking for... And I guess the overriding question here is, where are the weaknesses on the home front? And I'm thinking right now about the quality of discourse, but you might want to talk about other weaknesses. And I think Allegra, I might start with our two politicians and randomly choose Allegra first.
Quality of discourse nowhere near what it needs to be. And I will talk about the Israel-Hamas war, because I think that really exemplifies it. Certainly, you know, it is a time, it is really, it is such a difficult, for so many parts of the community, this is really hard. And when I talk to the, my community members, particularly the Jewish community that I know, they talk about three things. They talk about, firstly, blatant anti-Semitism, which, and, you know, there, you also spoke about, you know, the experience of Chinese Australians, and that's a blatant racism. But then they also talk about exclusion, which basically means that sort of, it's not necessarily anti-Semitism, but it means that they just don't feel like they are welcome. And then the other piece that I think I'm very concerned about is we are not having a thoughtful debate about this in a public arena. You know, certainly on social media, it is absolutely awful. But we are failing, I think, at all institutions, and I'd say universities, and I would say Parliament, of bringing the country together and saying, look, there's some difficult issues out here. How do we talk about this and listen and learn from each other? And I think we are truly failing. And so I think that's kind of, you know, the sort of the frame that I think of it. And then, you know, when I go, well, to the solution, because you have to be solution focused, I think, you know, firstly, there's this idea of sort of bonding capital and bridging capital. So bonding capital is often the capital, the social capital that holds communities together. And then bridging capital is the capital that brings people together from those different communities. And I think at the moment we are failing on that bridging capital that brings different parts of our community together. I think we are retreating into different parts of the community, and that is a problem. I think the second piece then is, you know, in investing in our democracy, investing in our media, and investing in parliamentary debate, and actually debate in our institutions like our universities. We need to get better at that, and Parliament is failing in terms of leading the way, and, you know, Question Time is a sewer. I've said that a number of times. It's a waste of time, but we are not leading there. And then finally, I think the other piece is also about economic growth, and I'll talk about the economy, because I think often when people think about unity and national unity, they think, so the economy is separate to this. But I think historically you've seen that, you know, when economy is going badly, when people are feeling like they don't have options, you get the rise of the far right. So unless we have an economy that where people feel like they have that sense of optimism, they have a sense of, I can make this work for me and my family, and that, you know, that the tide is lifting, then we will have a rise, I think, of the far right. So I think, you know, from a policy point of view, that sense of how do we build bridges, how do we improve the quality of our debate and lead by example, but then also how do we also make sure that the economy is working and also working for everyone? Those, I think, sort of three major themes in terms of political imperatives.
Weaknesses on the home front, Zoe. I don't want to confine you at all, but I just recall that Andrew Hastie spoke this morning about the importance of clarity of language, and he referenced a criticism that had been made by Foreign Minister Wong at the dinner last night about the leader of your party.
Oh, I didn't go to the dinner last night. I never go to anything that might be fun. So sorry. One thing I should say about what Andrew did say and refer back to it is his request to all of us that we be far more honest about the threats that we face. I sit on PJCIS and am constantly amazed by the extent to which we do not have a public discourse about the threats we are facing, and then we wonder why businesses, universities and others do not respond. So you hear Mike Berger say this regularly. I explain what's going on at his national address and then no one changes their behaviour because they haven't felt that it's part of their own backyard. We must be much more transparent, without giving the game away, of course, as to what the threats are and what we do about them. And then we must have a much more frank conversation about the fissures, the risk lines we have within our own system, whether it's the civic architecture, the way Parliament functions, but equally the world in which we live. We often talk about the importance of free speech in this country, and yet we do not be honest about the fact that there is no actual fair, open, transparent market about information. Invariably, the information, may I say, Asmi, congratulations that you had students watching the news, right? I can't find anyone under 20 watching the news except perhaps the lovely young man from my electorate who's studying here. We don't have young people watching the news. Their lives are fed to them by autoplay algorithmic design. We don't know what they're missing for. Yesterday, Beth Sanner told us that there had been two Republican chairs of committees in the US Congress where the congressmen are getting their information from Russian misinformation being pushed through evening debates on television. So free speech, terrific, but let's be honest about whether we are actually dealing with an open market. And then if we want to say you're allowed to have the algorithm, it's kind of like having drugs in sport. Let's have the drugged Olympics and the non-drugged ones. Let's have somewhere where at least you can get the information so that you can be informed if you want to, as opposed to having a very perverted, force-fed version of it, which leads exactly into what Allegra was saying about the anti-Semitism we saw. James Patterson did an excellent piece amongst other senatorial colleagues last year on social media and foreign interference. And it basically said, this is what can happen given the platforms we have now. We can turn up or turn down patriotism. We can turn up and turn down trust in institutions. Well, who knew it had already happened until the 7th of October, when all of a sudden we saw an explosion of anti-Semitism? And I thought, what? I didn't realise this had already happened. And so we must be honest that the current way we get information, the information we are fed, is absolutely not a pure and full market supporting one of the most important interests we all share, which is one of free speech. So plenty of weaknesses at the moment. Yeah.
Thank you. Wessa?
Yeah, I just wanted to add to what Zoe was saying about social media. And because when you really think about it, if people are not actually watching the news in a, you know, most people are not watching the news and not actually getting information from one source of information. What happens is if people don't feel included in the narrative, they'll stop listening. And what happens is they will then go and find sources that reflect their views and reflect their, you know, their views of the world. And that divides the community even more. So when we think about inclusion and when we think about, especially when we think about national identity, we're trying to look for the common, right? We're trying to look for something that is one. But then when their conversations and their views are not reflected in those conversations, that's when the society is divided, because they'll look for other things.
You'd like to come in too, ask me.
I really enjoyed the Honourable Shadow Minister for Defence's call for the good use of language and how we need to be careful about this. So people talk about democracy and people being elected. So Hamas was elected by their people. You know, that was a democratic choice. I don't know how good or how proper it was, I just have no idea, but I know that they were popularly elected. But when we conflate their military wings with their political wings, I think we do ourselves and our children a disservice. I think it's good to be able to use language. You know, English is a beautiful, rich language. You know, why don't we use the full extent of it and not conflate things when we have to? So I don't know whether the conflation is for politics or not, but, you know, If we are principle-based and say, look, people who commit crimes, whether they're from the military wing of Hamas or whether they're from the IDF or from, you know, from Timbuktu, they will be prosecuted to the full extent of the law, and not talk about things in a sectarian kind of way. And I think this helps our students. I know that our Jewish students and also our Muslim students really struggle with this issue. But, you know, our Jewish students and our Muslim students pray together. You know, they do Shabbat together and you know, some of them are celebrating the festival today. So, I mean, this is a good thing that young people are doing. I think older people need to follow what young people are doing. Somewhere along the road as we grow up, we become horrible, I think, you know.
Speak for yourself.
And speak for myself, yeah. Okay, I am speaking for myself. I mean, you look at the partisan politics. You think, you know, when we hear the minister and with respect to you, Shadow Minister, you think that the war is in Australia. You know, they're fighting each other. I thought the enemy was overseas. So, you know, this is what our kids see. And, you know, we don't want them to turn off politics. These are bright, smart people. We want them to go into politics.
Thanks, Hasmi. I really would like to carve out about 15 minutes for, and perhaps even more, for audience Q&A. But before we go there, I just want to ask one question of Afia. You've written quite a bit about our national projection and how effective that is. How do we improve? How do we get closer to that ideal that Tim Watts spoke about earlier this morning in terms of our national projection?
Yeah, definitely. So as already identified by Tim Watts, we're an Indo-Pacific country with a highly multicultural society. So let's leverage and further build our Asian literacy to engage with the region. So the research, it shows that it's a lot easier for children to learn languages than opposed to adults. But at the university level, such as at ANU, there are a wide range of languages offered. Well, you don't necessarily see that in primary schools and secondary schools, that investment in language learning. In 2021, for example, only less than 10% of Year 12 students were studying a foreign language. When it comes to engaging with the region, according to DFAT, we need to be investing more in languages which are termed as national strategic priority languages. So those are the languages of Arabic, Bahasa, Mandarin, Japanese, and Korean. But when it comes to building Asian literacy as well, we have already an inbuilt advantage by the fact that not only can we be trained in next generation, but looking at diaspora communities as well who often have these intercultural linguistic skills already. The last Australian census showed that over 22% of the Australian population spoke a language other than English at home. And those top three languages were Mandarin, Arabic, and Vietnamese, which are all languages integral for engaging for our region. And as identified by Tim Watts, we have politicians with multicultural backgrounds, and we have diplomats with these backgrounds, like Penny Wong using her Bahasa skills, His Excellency Ridwan Jadwat leveraging his Muslim faith and also his multicultural background on his postings. So definitely there is a lot we can do in terms of building our national influence, but it, as I mentioned, it's not necessarily just taking for granted that we do have this multiculturalism, but it is about leveraging that specifically by showing multicultural communities that we do value their skills when it comes to national security, and that there is a future beyond just at the community level using your language skills and your intercultural skills, but that is really valued when it comes to projecting our narratives and investing in the next generation as well when it comes to education, scholarships such as the New Colombo Plan, highlighting that there are opportunities to use those skills as well.
Thanks, Hafia. All right, over to the audience. I've been given permission to eat into your morning tea just a little, only a little, and I already see a hand here. Are there mics or... There we are, just behind you. Thanks.
Thank you so much. Tamerlane Beasley from Beasley Intercultural. An extraordinary panel this morning, and it was interesting yesterday, Lieutenant General... General Simon Stewart, Chief of Army, said that the most important thing we need to address is who are we and what are we fighting for? So this issue of identity keeps coming up. The question I have for the panel is, to what extent do you think we're accessing diverse perspectives so that we really know what the region is thinking of us and thinking of our approaches, and that is informing our national security policy?
Who'd like to lead? Wessel, would you like to start?
Yeah, so I think, thanks for the question. I think it's really important to have people or representative of people in all the institutions in Australia. So when we think about representation and cultural diversity in senior roles, it's not very good. The data shows that it's quite bad, and also especially in the public service, there was a research that came out to show that there's the Asian penalty. So if you're from an Asian background, if you work in a public service, your likelihood to get promotion is even less than people who are from a different cultural background. So or women. So it looks into all these different areas as well. So when it comes to understanding the region and we don't have people of those backgrounds in our institutions that can provide those perspectives, that's when we don't hear about it. And the other one is also making use of the talents that we have, especially in for international students, for example. Like I said, you know, we have international students who have perspectives of their home country, but then when they talk about their perspectives at universities, some of them are not welcomed And so what happens is after they've done it a few times, they'll stop doing it. And so when we think about wanting to capture those perspectives of people from other countries and what they think, we don't actually understand that. We don't actually have those information. So when I go overseas, for example, sometimes the first thing people talk to me about is, oh, is Australia very racist? Like, this is the first question they would ask me. And obviously it's a very challenging questions to answer, you know, with one line. But that's the perspective of certain people in other countries. And they only said that to me because I look Asian and they feel like I'll understand.
Afia.
Yeah, really fantastic question, and definitely echo all Wes's points. I think National Security College is doing a great job when it comes to this front in terms of trying to engage with diverse perspectives as seen through this panel as well, and the fact that we did have a cold NSC podcast series and also a mentoring program for young women and culturally and linguistically diverse Australian ANU students. I think the other thing as well that we really need to remember is when it comes to engaging with the region, there still is this perception that we are an Anglo-Saxon majority, neo-imperial power, and that's how we engage in the region. So as highlighted through the Shadow Defence Minister, the fact that there is this concept of Pax Americana, Pax Britannica, and that we are just a lapdog or we are a deputy sheriff for the US within the region. So to combat that, we really do need to leverage on our multicultural communities and ensure that we are engaging in languages and within the values of the region. And I think a really good example of that when it comes to security challenges in the region is how we tackle climate change. So Australia has recently entered into the Fallopilla Union Treaty with Tuvalu, which is a landmark climate mobility arrangement for 280 Tuvaluans to come to Australia every year to work, study, and to live in response to rising sea levels in Tuvalu. But I think the concern for a lot of Pacific Island countries is that are we just engaging with the region because we're trying to combat China's rise and that we are trying to increase our reach and influence? What about actually helping the region to adapting to climate change, such as through mitigating fossil fuel emissions in the first place or assisting in terms of land reclamation? So it seems to be a very last resort solution where we are encouraging migration as opposed to looking at the root of the problem where Australia's coal industry and how we go about life here is really contributing to this crisis in the Pacific. So it really is about listening to the voices of the region, and diaspora communities are one part of that, but also more broadly going to communities and talking about these issues as opposed to politically motivated decisions based on geopolitics.
Should we go to another question, or people burning to answer on? Great. Another question.
Hi, I'm Susan Harris-Rimmer from Griffith University. I do research on security vetting at the moment, and I'm very interested in how diversity issues are affecting security vetting processes, very long delays for Chinese Australians, lots of issues for First Nations people in terms of documentation, lots of issues for Muslim Australians still. So how do we get the... We've heard a lot about recruitment issues in our national security agencies, and yet we have quite an old-fashioned, I would argue, security vetting process that does often think about diversity as a risk. So let's have a chat about it. I'd love to hear some reflections on that.
You look keen, Asmin.
Yeah. Hello, Susan. Thank you for your question. I don't like actually the use of the term First Nations because that's an American term and it means that people have ceded sovereignty, which we haven't done. That's the common law meaning. So the international term is Indigenous and the legislative term in Australia is Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, whether you like those terms or not. So I think there are huge problems with the Aboriginal community, with birth certificates and all of that. But I really need to, you know, the security agencies that do this vetting, none of our Aboriginal, not none, but none of the Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander students that I knew had a problem with this because they are so sensitive. They are so good at what they do. And, you know, they were not delayed at all in terms of taking up their jobs. So while, people have a go at the defence establishment or the intelligence kind of people, my experience and the experience of my students, and when they call to check things that they can check because they don't have a complete information, they're really professional, really thorough, and they're very, very, very sensitive to these issues. So I hope that the broader community can reflect those values. It'd be absolutely fabulous. Sorry, that's just one perspective. I think people born overseas might have a very different perspective.
Zoe?
I would suggest from sad and sorry experience that our vetting procedures, at least historically, they may be better now, but my last experience with it was in 2013, leave much to be desired. You know, they ask you things like anywhere you've been in the last 10 years, any foreign people you might know. Well, I'd lived and worked in France for a year, 3 years before I came back, and it's just, you know, it's impossible. It is literally impossible. And then to top it off, I said, can I just give you between 2007 and 13? Because obviously you got my file from before then. And they said, no, you have to start from the beginning. And I said, why? And they said, because we've lost your file. And I said, well, that's not such a good system, really, is it? So anyway, the system needs an overhaul, but I think that system is getting an overhaul, but I'm not sure that it particularly penalises one group more than another. It's just at various points been shambolic.
And I just wanted to add, I mean, I always say, like, you start with the data. Look, I think there are a lot of, I don't know in specifically how this works, but I'd be going, okay, what are the problems with the funnels of getting, you know, a diverse group of Australians into the system? As you say, you talked about the sort of bamboo ceiling. But it's just sort of be going, what's the data? Are you losing people because they're not applying? Are you losing people at the vetting stage? Are you losing people at the, at the first kind of promotion stage? Or at the sort of lateral higher stage? Because I think that gives the best sort of way of just saying, well, where's actually the problem? Because maybe it is in vetting, but maybe that's actually not the problem. It might be slower, but maybe that's not actually holding us back from recruiting Muslim Australians into the security system, and it's actually something else. But that's always how I would think about it. And certainly, I think we need to think, you know, more broadly, like, you know, to the point, the earlier question, our parliament does not yet reflect the diversity of our country. And, you know, that is a problem. It doesn't even reflect the gender diversity of our country. And that's kind of simpler. But, you know, we have a lot of, you know, work to do to make sure all of our institutions truly reflect and actually harness that diversity, because that is powerful.
And I might just add, obviously research to show that, especially if you're from born overseas, makes it really challenging for you to get security clearance. So it is a question of what the actual issue is. Now, I don't know much about security clearance, so I can't really, you know, talk into exactly how you might be able to change it. But then I agree with Algra that we need to look into the data. Where is it that people are not progressing? And then find a solution as to how we can resolve that.
Thank you. I think we've got room for one more. I see a hand in the middle here.
Thank you very much, everyone on the panel. Eleanor Fogarty from Department of Industry, Science and Resources, and I'm also an undergraduate student here at the ANU doing security. Now, as someone that was born in the War on Terror era and the, you know, very much a multicultural era in Australia, the perception of the national security community amongst young people often appears to be an antithesis to multiculturalism, and it often is an issue for getting young people into both the APS and the national security community. Now, clearly that's a problem if we have, you know, our wonderful colleagues here have been in the national security community for 10 years. They're going to age out, and we're not going to have anyone to replace them unless the national security community is seen to be more multicultural. Thank you for highlighting that. What are some ways that you think that young Australians can be more engaged with national security as unifying us to protect the multicultural values that we have, but also ensuring that we can progress in future both through climate action and other areas through the expanded concept of security that we now have?
Well, I don't want to insult the other members of the panel, but I mean, let's ask a young Australian. I know there are other young Australians, but I think of Afia to begin with.
Yeah, sure. I think that's a fantastic question. I'm a woman of colour with Muslim faith background, so these are questions that I often think about within my own short career within this space. In particular, I very much believe in the idea of that you can't be what you can't see. So when it comes to government, if you don't see people of colour, if you don't see people from diverse sexualities, if you don't see those people within leadership, what incentive is there for young Australians to try and get through our system when it's so stacked against you? So it really is about not only within the pipeline in government, but also, yeah, bringing people in through the recruitment aspect. In particular, I see that there's a lot of narrative in this space that, oh, you have to speak multiple languages, you have to have a security background to be working in national security, but it's much broader than that. It's a whole ecosystem. There are a lot of students at ANU, for example, who learn languages for the love of learning languages, but they don't see that there is a use for that beyond becoming a language teacher, or that they think the only option is DFAT. But even in my own place, workplace at ASPE, you can use language skills in terms of open source research. And also when it comes to data science skills, HR, engineering, these are all skills valued within the national security community. So it really is overhauling these traditional perspectives and perceptions of what the national security community is and doing more of that outreach. I think also going outside the Canberra bubble as well, because as we've talked about, there's a very vibrant multicultural and diverse community around Australia. Go to Western Sydney, where it's very normal for people to speak an additional language, but are we doing outreach in those communities? So it's great that the NSC will be going on the road for these community consultations. And I think that really is the first step to understanding this issue by talking to the community through qualitative data. At the same time as well, quantitative data is really important. And a current gap in government is the fact that we don't currently collate data on ethnicity, and also in Australian society more broadly in the census. We have a number of proxies for cultural diversity when it comes to the census, such as country you were born, first language spoken, and so on. For me, I was born in Australia. My first language is English, but my ethnic background, that's not necessarily captured in census data. So when it comes to looking at the public service, when it comes to looking at national security, we really need to ensure that those metrics of diversity are captured. Of course, there are reasons people might not want to identify their background, but where possible to encourage this collation of data, which is the first step to understand the problem, and through those community consultations and qualitative insights as well to really make that more robust.
Thank you. That's a last brief word.
Yes. I just want to say, like, there's a lot of decision makers in this room. So I think one way to do it is really for everyone in a role that enables them to think about diversity in their hiring, and also credit to Rory and the National Security College that they've put effort into diversifying the panels, and I think that's really important. And without that, we can't have this frank conversation and have different perspectives on these issues as well.
You've just stolen my final point. But look, I think that's right. I think that the quality and diversity of this panel is quite extraordinary. We could go on forever. Hopefully people will be hanging around for morning tea and be able to engage further. But I think the quality of the panel and diversity has been reflected in the discussion, and I want to ask you to join me in thanking them.